content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. So in this episode, we'll continue to dig a little deeper into the April issue of Our State Magazine, which is all about modern vintage experiences that blend contemporary with classic to create experiences that are refreshingly retro. So if you find yourself in Durham, you might enjoy exploring the Golden Age of Durham Dining. A revival of one of Blue City's original special occasion restaurants harks back to an era of white tablecloths, impeccable service, and timeless flavors. The bar purrs, ice rattles against a shaker, keeping rough time with the lo-fi blues spilling from the speakers. Around the room, conversations hum like bumblebees, floating over the clink and chime of glasses and silverware. At Nana's, time hangs suspended between past and present. There's the decor, a contemporary homage to mid-century glamour and Ralph Lauren's classic vision of American style. The menu, a mingling of familiar and reinterpreted classics. And the name, a celebration of grandmothers everywhere. For more than 25 years, under the ownership of Chef Scott Howell, the restaurant stood out as a bright star in Durham's dining cosmos until it closed, seemingly for good, in 2020. But one veteran of the Durham dining scene couldn't bear to see it go. When Chef Matt Kelly resurrected the restaurant in 2023 with partner Chef Nate Garyantis, they zeroed in on what made it so special. "We want Nana's to feel like the neighborhood's living room," Kelly says. "And like any good living room, it's comfortable, comforting. It feels like home." The shady streets of Durham's Rockwood neighborhood haven't changed much since Howell landed there in 1992, ready at age 29 to move on from the itinerant chef's life and settle into his own kitchen. An Asheville native and Appalachian State alumnus, he'd spent years training at the Culinary Institute of America and working for famous chefs in New York, Italy, and Los Angeles before he was called home. Ben Barker, owner of Durham's legendary Magnolia Grill, was on the line, offering Howell a position as sous chef. After an 18-month tenure at Magnolia Grill, Howell struck out on his own, a vision of what would become Nana's clear in his mind, fresh, local food, and attentive, knowledgeable service. It wasn't easy. The concept would make Nana's an outlier in Durham, where most fine dining was, according to Howell, stuffy, steaks and twice-baked potatoes and airline chicken breast, prime rib carved thick on Saturday nights. He persisted, couch surfing and purchasing the liquor for Nana's bar on his maitre d's credit card. Howell's efforts paid off. Months after Nana's opened in 1993, Esquire included it on a list of best new restaurants, calling it a perfect example of how regional American food, sensibly influenced by non-traditional flavors, is unbeatable when it comes to gastronomic satisfaction. The James Beard Foundation came knocking next with 8 consecutive semifinalist nods for Best Chef Southeast. As the years ticked by and the calendar turned 2018, Howell had his eye on the exit. Decades in the kitchen, the exhaustive creative grind, rising expenses, and the aftermath of a near-fatal accident, a 1,200-pound grill fell and shattered his leg, had grown burdensome. He knew it was time to pursue other projects. Word got out. The community responded. Chefs lauded Howell's vision and impact on Durham's culinary culture. Diners lamented the loss of their favorite spot and filled reservation books in a flash. That spring, a 200-person-strong contingent of chefs and former employees feted Howell. He sat for interviews, talking about his past career and future direction. "I got to live my dream," he told the Raleigh News and Observer. As he spoke, his voice was heavy and tears gleamed in his eyes. That wasn't the final act for Nana's. Howell reopened the restaurant after 9 months away, but less than a year later faced the growing global pandemic that was already shaping the restaurant industry. He closed his doors for a final time, but he got to live his dream. Dreams, especially those as impactful as Nana's, don't die easily. Nana's was everything I admired and worshipped, Kelly says now. I wouldn't be working in this town if it were not for Nana's. In 2022, Kelly stepped in with an offer to purchase the restaurant. Howell accepted. Few others had the culinary or business chops to revive Nana's and keep it at the top of the city's now robust food scene, but Kelly was ready. Since beginning work at the French restaurant Vin Rouge in 2002, he'd become a driving force in building Durham's reputation as a dining destination, taking the helm at beloved restaurants like Mateo Bar Tapas and St. James Seafood. His work had earned him James Beard Best Chef, Southeast semifinalist honors 4 times. Kelly was perfectly positioned to carry on Nana's name, but with a change. No apostrophe. Under his hand, Nana's would honor the legacy and love of all grandmothers. He and his business partner, Gariantis, chef de cuisine at Nana's, take their role as stewards seriously. This restaurant is a legend, a legacy, Gariantis says, and we get to carry that on. Howell described his original vision for Nana's as coming out of the 1980s when food became important. Under Kelly's guidance, though, cuisine and decor have evolved. Step through the door at the reimagined Nana's and you've arrived at somewhere, at some other where, some other when. Emerald tiles climb the walls, mingling with dark wood trim and brass accents, creating an effect reminiscent of a forest. A plush orange bench, bright as a prized clutch of chanterelles, rendered in velvet, invites you to sit. But if you do, you may be late for your reservation, so you make your way to the host station. There you get your first peek at the dining room and lounge-like bar. Plaid carpet, based on a plaid shirt Kelly often wears, leads to and through the dining room, often softening footfalls and absorbing the noise of the restaurant, but also pulling colors from the tobacco leaf tabletops, bound in bright brass, and the caramel leather banquettes and the dark rattan-backed chairs with plush cushions. A dozen other details go unnoted but not unnoticed. Instead, they take root in diners, ease them in deeper into their seats and camaraderie, and set the stage for a meal as thoughtfully crafted as the space. Design and comfort were huge drivers for us, Kelly says. We can create a sense of discovery in our guests as they move through the restaurant to their seat. No easy feat for Nana's, where any given night sees diners loyal for a generation or more walk through the door. So when Kelly and Gariantis took over in 2022, they spent more than a year on the design, build-out, and concept. The result is a restaurant space and menu that make guests feel they belong, as comfortable for your grandmother as your 20-something cousin. Both would rave about the meal and how cool the place feels. We were purposeful in our design, building an unobtrusive sound-dampening elements like the carpet in the dining room. What says Grandma's house more than carpet in the dining room? And baffles hidden away in the ceilings, Kelly says. Why go the extra mile? Because, he says, conversation and fellowship over delicious food is the cornerstone of our vision. If the design sets the stage, dinner seals the deal. In the same way the space hangs between vintage chic and modern masterpiece, so too does the menu. Cooking at Vin Rouge, it crystallized for me that restaurants serve one guest, one plate at a time, Kelly says. When Nate and I were creating the menu here, we asked ourselves, what plates from that Nana's belong in this Nana's? Several dishes remain, like the decadent chicken liver mousse, the deeply flavored shrimp risotto, the chicken roasted in a cast iron pan. Following Ben Barker's recipe from the now-shuttered Magnolia Grill, Grits, Humble and Homey get an indulgent makeover as a sky-high souffle laced with chanterelles and foie gras. Desserts like crème brûlée and banana pudding, bombe, recognizable on a plate and the palate, get glow-ups that don't overshadow the originals. Other dishes are new. Gariantis, a veteran of bold, experimental kitchens, delivers a delicious bite in the scallop Milanese, a love letter to North Carolina from Italy. Succulent bay scallops surround a pair of fried scallops. An intense beurre fondue brings each bite together. That rye tagliatelle, rich in flavor and texture, comes with an avalanche of duck cracklin crumbs and a silky duck ragout. For dessert, the hot chocolate souffle, a thing of beauty even before the server pours piping hot fudge over the top, draws the envious eyes of everyone around. The menu may make you weep tears of joy, but it's the people who keep you coming back. Hospitality here, as with all of Kelly's restaurants, is impeccable, as rare in today's world of fast casual dining as it was in Howell's day, when such service existed mostly in the rarefied air of the local country clubs. Servers know the menu front and back, of course, but they also know how to read a table and pace a meal accordingly. When diners linger over cocktails, their server might stretch time, giving them a few more moments of conversation. Unsure what to order? With a few probing questions and careful observations, the wait staff offers gentle guidance. Everyone in this restaurant is intentional with what they do. Kelly says, together we curate an experience for the diners. In a region that's rapidly changing, Nana's is a touchstone, striking a balance between old and new. Whether it's paying homage to Durham's tobacco-stained history, serving beloved dishes from the past, or reinvigorating classics and inspiring the city's next great chef, Nana's is more than a restaurant. It's a legacy. For more information on Nana's Rockwood, check out their website at nanasrockwood.com. For our next experience, we'll head to Stokes County and get a taste of Stokes County at Mitchell's Butchery. This is called Making the Cut. Some believe that the days of the friendly neighborhood butcher, the one who knows your name and order, are behind us. But at one family-owned business in the foothills, quality meat and service are always on the menu. A bus from South Stokes High School sits in front of Mitchell's Butchery. Inside the shop, a group of students crowd around the butcher table behind the meat coolers. Before them lies the culmination of their class project, half of a pig carcass. Most of the kids are dressed in jeans and boots. A few live on nearby farms. Some are on the livestock show team. Still others are part of Future Farmers of America. By now, they're used to working with the animals. All eyes are on head butcher Zev Flinchman as he begins cutting up the pork. "Where does the loin come off?" Sawyer Ferguson, the agriculture teacher and FAA advisor, asks the group as Flinchum points out the muscle that runs from one end of the pork to the other. "The back," a few students answer. "Very good," Ferguson responds with a smile. Carl Mitchell, chief of operations, walks over to join the conversation. "This is my favorite cut of meat right here," he says, motioning to the tenderloin, a small, narrow muscle that's located at the back of the pork loin. Carl participates in the rest of the demonstration, pointing out different parts of the pork as Flinchum finishes his cut. At the front of Mitchell's Bakery, behind the cash register, a sign displays the four core principles of the business. Put on an interactive show is number two. Here, education is key. The Mitchells, Carl and his wife Christy, opened their Walnut Cove storefront in September 2024 with the goal of selling quality meat to as many people as possible. It's not a revolutionary concept. It's reminiscent of how things used to be, when the local butcher knew to set aside an especially tender roast for a loyal customer's Sunday supper. But now, local butchers are few and far between. Today, Carl says, the average person is four generations removed from the farm. At Mitchell's, the couple connects with their customers with local farmers. On a cooler of chicken, a sign reads, "Where does our chicken come from?" The answer, Wayne Farms in Dobson, where the birds eat a vegetarian diet and aren't raised on antibiotics. Similar signage hangs near other products like cheese, milk, and honey. Carl and Christy highlight a sort of farmer on tap each week. Today, the beef in the display case comes from Farmstead on a Hill in Lawsonville. By championing small farmers who raise meat with care and attention to detail, the couple bridges the distance most of us have from the land. Building that bridge takes a lot of work and knowledge, and the Mitchell stores are just one aspect. Among their others are meat processing plant and 260-acre beef farm. Stokes County is a network of hills and hollers scattered around high peaks of the Sarratown Mountains. The Mitchell's farm, located about 10 minutes west of their Walnut Cove butchery in a community called Germantown, is laid out in much the same way. Carl and Christie's home sits off a narrow dirt road near the entrance to their property. Their Great Dane Thor, German Shepherd Hazel and Mutt Motor circle the couple, barking as they head out the dirt-smeared front door and get into the family's red pickup. The Mitchells' nearly 80 Angus cattle are spread throughout their land and Carl's parents' adjacent property. Farming family land is a way of life that not many people can relate to anymore, but the experience has given the Mitchells confidence and pride in their community. Not too far from their house, Carl points out the first herd. A group of calves flick their tails and point their damp noses toward the ground. "We haven't bought a cow since 1992," he says. "We've raised every single cow that's here." In 1976, Carl's father, Johnny, bought 40 acres to grow tobacco. Johnny worked as a mailman, and his wife, Sue, taught home economics at South Stokes High School. The sale of tobacco paid for Carl's college education. He studied zoology at NC State and helped the family expand the property to its current 260 acres. After Carl left for school, the Mitchells stopped growing tobacco and transitioned to raising and selling cattle. And even though Carl was always working cattle, a desire to serve others led him to another full-time job, teaching. That's how he met Christy in 2006. She was teaching 7th grade math at the Academy at Lincoln in Greensboro. He was teaching 7th grade science. "I met her in August," Carl says. "We were dating in September, and we were married in July." Christy, who grew up in the suburbs in Ohio, never imagined that her adult life would revolve around farm chores. "This was completely new to me," she says, "but dating Carl means you're dating the farm, too." Driving around the Mitchells' land doesn't feel like taking a tour of the stereotypical wide-open cattle pasture. It's hilly and bumpy, and there are trees that frame the horizon. This region of North Carolina, the northwestern Piedmont, up through the Appalachians, is the best place to raise livestock, Carl says. The diversity of grass, amount of rainfall, and climate create ideal conditions for cattle. In places like Montana, it can take a farmer 10 acres to raise one cow. "Here, we can do it on an acre and a half to 2 acres per cow," Carl says. A smaller farm also means the couple can take care of their entire herd with the help of their two children, Caleb, 15, and Annie, 13. "I don't know how I'd be able to raise kids without a farm," Carl says. "All the lessons you learn. The farm has never been a question of are we or aren't we going to do it." After spending about a decade teaching, Carl took over a Stokes County Livestock Cooperative Extension agent in 2016. That position allowed him to stay on top of the latest research in his field while also forming and fostering relationships with local cattle farmers and understanding their needs. Not long after, Carl and Christy got their meat handler's license and started selling meat from their garage. As the couple began formulating ideas about what the future could hold, they got wind that Mitchell's Meat Processing, the local slaughterhouse run by a different set of Mitchells with no relation, was going to close. Carl turned to Christy and said, "What if we do this?" In 2018, Christy bought the plant. A few years later, the couple found a storefront in Walnut Cove where they could sell their meat to customers. This past January, they opened another butcher shop in King, and thanks to a $3.1 million grant that Carl received from the North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, the couple was able to buy land nearby to build another meat processing plant. They hope to open the plant sometime in the next year or two. Their intent is to give North Carolina meat farmers another place to sell their products, which will help teach more people about the benefits of supporting local agriculture. For the Mitchells, splitting their time between the farm, the meat processing plant, and their storefronts isn't just executing a business plan. It's preserving a way of life. "We need to have farms that are profitable in order to keep them," Carl says. In October, after Hurricane Helene ravaged western North Carolina, Carl drove to Bat Cave to donate 2 800-pound loads of meat. He connected with an apple farmer there who'd lost everything in the storm. "In the middle of harvest season, the place is absolutely devastated," Carl says. "And who's cleaning up the road? Roads, it's the farmers, because they're able. If farms don't survive, we will lose our culture. We will lose our community." After driving around the Mitchell's farm, it's time for the couple to stop by the Walnut Cove shop and check in with their staff. Carl pulls out of their property and on to North Carolina Highway 8. As he drives, Carl reflects on springtime at the farm. An ideal day is a day when nothing breaks. That's rare. But on a perfect day, he likes to stand in the pasture and spend time with his cows. to look up at the sky and out on his land, and to give silent thanks for a community and livelihood that have taught him every life lesson. There's two locations for Mitchell's stores. One's Mitchell's Brewery in Walnut Cove, North Carolina. And then there's Mitchell's Chop Shop in King, North Carolina. And you can find out more about each of them on their website at mitchellsbutcherync.com. That's mitchellsbutcherync.com. Our next experience pops up in Goldsboro. Ride the rails on the Goldsboro Special. I'm not yet as tall as the chain link fence at Herman Park, a green space spanning a city block in the center of Goldsboro. It's a spring day in the early 1980s. The sprawling magnolias are blooming, their scent carrying on a breeze as warm as a breath. It's my first time standing on the dirt platform that serves as the station for the Kiwanis Special, a miniature train that runs around a quarter-mile track in one corner of the city's oldest park. I try to swallow my uncertainty of boarding in one of the train cars, but there's not much time to dwell on it. The conductor has climbed down from the engine and opened the gate. I take my father's hand, and together we step forward. Up close, I'm relieved. The Kiwanis Special is my size, with open-air seats and just enough space to tuck in my legs. If the conductor recites a list of rules, I don't remember. A stoplight next to the track turns green, and the train rumbles to a start, its speed swelling just enough to rustle my hair. As we enter a tunnel just after the first bend, the world falls dark and everyone around me starts to scream, even the grown-ups. I throw my head back laughing and join in the cacophony. The train began operating the summer of 1955 after the Kiwanis Club of Goldsboro purchased it from the city of Whiteville for $8,500. It was one of about 240 like it ever built. Only about 40 still remain. The service organization has been managing it with an all-volunteer staff ever since. The Kiwanis Special carried its first passengers when my father was just a year old, and city streets teemed with shoppers and diners and business people. He grew up on West Grantham Street, an easy bike ride from Herman Park, where the train was as permanent and ordinary as the park's magnolias that he climbed in summer. Still, train rides were reserved for special occasions like Sunday picnics, while grown-ups lounged in the shade or peered into the goldfish pond, another of the park's permanent draws. Children clamored for a 10-cent fare that took them to unexpected places, through a tunnel with murals on the walls, across the Grand Canyon, the sign at the bridge said as much, the dark tunnel where you could throw your arms up and scream as loud as you wanted. As generations of riders like my dad made countless trips around the track, time and wear took their toll on the Kiwanis Special, and by 2021, it had undergone multiple repairs and was nearly the end of its run. That's when the Kiwanis Club launched an ambitious $125,000 fundraising campaign to replace the well-loved relic. The organization raised more than twice its goal thanks to hundreds of families like mine who bought bricks that bear the names of loved ones. It purchased a replica of the Kiwanis Special, which made its first appearance in May 2022, as well as a new train station and brick patio that opened the following spring. 7 decades have passed since my dad first rode the train, and now my children stand no taller than that chain-link fence. I watch as they take in the scene before them, a train piled with children and grown-ups pulling into the station. My son 3 needs no convincing to climb aboard, but I can sense my 4-year-old daughter's uncertainty. I tell her how Papa, who has just arrived with a strip of tickets as long as his arm, rode the train when he was a little boy, and how I rode it when I was her age. Come on, I say. We'll go together. It'll be fun. Maybe she's convinced, or maybe she just swallows her fear, but she agrees. I find a seat and take her hand and help her in beside me. My dad and son settle in behind us, 3 generations of passengers aboard the Kiwanis Special. The train my dad rode pulls out of the station and heads for the first bend in the tunnel beyond. In the darkness, I feel for my daughter's hand. We throw back our heads and scream in delight. For more information, check out the website. If you're in Goldsboro, it's GoldsboroTrain2022.com. That's GoldsboroTrain2022.com. Our next experience is in Jacksonville. Taste tradition at Walton's Distillery. Still history. A Jacksonville attorney came home to practice law and continue a family legacy of making moonshine using a cherished recipe more than a century old. Step inside Don Walton Jr.'s distillery in Jacksonville and you see it. It's in the center of the tasting room, a still made with country ingenuity, a black barrel, stainless steel drum, and a beer keg that served as a filter. Walter's cousin Norwood Rochelle built the still, and the two of them used it to carry on a family tradition at Walton's distillery, making moonshine. The cousins relied on a recipe that generations of their family used to create this illegal liquor. Their relatives had been making it this way since before Prohibition, more than 100 years ago. "I want to preserve my heritage," Walton says. I like the old ways, I guess. Walton grew up in Jacksonville and moved to Kentucky in the 1980s for a job after graduating from UNC Wilmington. A few years later, he enrolled at law school at the University of Kentucky. While living in Lexington, he toured distilleries and pored through records at the university library, learning about pre-Prohibition recipes and distilleries and dreaming of opening his own one day. After law school, he returned to Jacksonville to be closer to family, and in 2013, when Walton finally built his distillery, Rochelle came to see him. Rochelle, who was in his 70s, sat with his cousin in the distilling room and discussed making moonshine. Rochelle had been making it in the woods of Onslow County for a half century, and he and his older cousins didn't want the family tradition to die. He became the teacher and showed his younger cousin how to make moonshine in a 30-gallon copper still. "Look," Walton told Rochelle, "I want a still like you would use in the woods." "Well," his cousin responded, "let's go to the salvage yard." "I wanted to recreate as much as I could the manner in which my family had made moonshine in the woods," said Walton, who still practices law in his hometown. "To share the history, the cultural aspect of it, people fabricated all kinds of vessels to make moonshine or to distill. People just made use of what they had." The family tradition can be seen in the bottles and jars on Walton's distillery liquor as well. Walton named his products after his ancestors and put their black and white portraits on the labels. E.M. Walton's straight bourbon whiskey, after his great-grandfather. Junior Walton's authentic Carolina moonshine, after his grandfather. Kitty Walton's apple pie moonshine, after his great-grandmother. On the back of some jars of moonshine is an old photograph of Rochelle in his characteristic trucker hat, sometimes holding a fiddle. "I promised him before he passed that I would never sell a jar of moonshine without his picture being on it and him getting credit for it," Walton says. Although the two didn't know each other well before making moonshine together, Walton says he cherishes the memories he made with Rochelle. When Walton bought the land for his distillery on Ben Williams Road, he found scrap barrels and drums. A neighbor later told him almost everyone along the road had been involved in making moonshine at some point. He also makes bourbon and still likes to drink it, but there's something special about shine. Walton would take jars of it back to his friends in Kentucky to try. "We were there with all these nice distilleries in a part of bourbon country," he said, "and they wanted to try some moonshine from North Carolina. What did it taste like? Like it does now. Good." For more information about Walton's Distillery, check out their website, waltonsdistillery.com. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of the magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of our state is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.